Okay. Okay, welcome to After the Collapse. This is a special recording, live recording for After the Collapse on RadioRegent.com. It's going to be an hour long, then it's going to be followed by Mike Keith's fantastic Tinderbox open mic. So I'm Lewis.
And I'm Jim.
And thank you for coming, if you came for this. And if you didn't, you're in for a big surprise and much entertainment. So tonight is a special issue of our show. It's an investigative poetry night. Jim, do you want to explain a little bit about investigative poetry?
Sure. This is our second annual investigative poetry night where we honor the gentle soul of Ed Sanders, the great beatnik leader who invented the concept of scholar-activist poetry. And so the poems tonight will all be investigations of vital political topics centered around the theme of
Climate change tonight.
Yeah, so I believe Lewis will start off by telling us a little bit about scholar activism.
And yes, then I'm going to do that by actually reading an Ed Sanders poem. Do you want to? All right, so our first poem of the evening, written by Ed Sanders, provided to me by Jim. And it's called For the Scholar Activists. Some are happy in a quiet room, weaving maps with Clio's loom. Some are satisfied with graph and list, but not the scholar activist. Months spent down on a screen or page like a monk in a stoic cell of rage, till you burst out laughing to the polis tent, planting the banners of betterment. Keep knowledge new, O activists. Know the fresh facts first, O scholars. Before the story is flung to freeze, O scholar activists. Don't hesitate to stare at forever, for such a viewing shall deliver you a boat with a truth-tinged sail. And do not be afraid to forge a wand of adamant to lead an orchestra of facts on the polis green. Get ready for derision, but ready, too, for the blinding light that Plato spoke about in Book 9, O scholar activists. Cast off thy cloaks of dark, data-soaked remorse, O scholar scribes. Rise, O activists, shaking your scrolls that burn without harming. Roll forth, O scholars. Some of you may wind up in prison for confronting the military-industrial surrealists, or those who would murder water and air. Do not despair, for victory often arrives with invisible letters. If some of you fall in your blazes of leaflets like the Gracchi or the Miners of Colorado, let your names be recorded. In the legend told to children for 500 years. I am beating on a bottle of mental burgundy light years across to shout your emergence, O scholar activists. So go, essays, go, go, build thou now the betterment. That's what the crack in the bell is singing. Move your galacto gluts through the channels of time, O scholar activists, till you lay down your gigabyte burdens to kiss the fragment of Gaia and the ground-up volumes of Star.
All right, so there you go. The great Ed Sanders. So that's roughly the kind of thing we...
Thank you very much. Thank you.
That's roughly the kind of thing we'll be doing tonight. Investigative poetry, poetry grounded in real-life events. And in between, we'll be having songs related to the poems.
Okay, so Jim, Jim's going to read the first poem of the evening, also by Ed Sanders. And do you want to intro this at all, Jim?
Sure.
Okay. Jim Vernon.
Hello. I'll apologize at the start for this one being kind of a downer. When Lewis asked that I select something from Ed to read that was an investigative poem on the theme of climate change, I first looked at some of his nature poetry, which is all brilliant, kind of short. But this week we learned about the illness of our mayor, and all had on our mind the struggles people have through illness. And I instantly thought of a poem Ed wrote in honor of the great conservation activist Rachel Carson, who wrote her masterwork, The Silent Spring, while battling her own probably pesticide-induced cancer. And so this is sort of a slightly downer-ish poem about the struggle of Rachel Carson to finish the book and to get the Wildlife Act passed in the last years of her life. It's a little long. I apologize. I'll just start. So this
it's not crazy long.
No.
It's like 5 minutes.
Yeah, it's like 3 minutes. Four minutes. So this is an ode to Rachel Carson. The Sea Around Us was published in 1951 and won the National Book Award and the Burroughs Medal. It sold 250,000 copies that year and made her a national treasure. She'd been one of the first women to hold an upper position with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. In early June of 1960, she served in the National Resource Committee of the Democratic Advisory Council and listed for the committee the issue she thought most vital: pollution control, radioactive contamination of the sea, chemicals poisoning the air, water, and land, preservation of wild space, and the Wilderness Bill. Let's get it passed. That was the year she suffered the irony of researching the book, tracking the relationship of pesticides and disease, while she herself fell prey. She'd been surging ahead in her book, encouraged by her editor at The New Yorker, when in January of 60, her doctors found a duodenal ulcer, and then the same month, viral pneumonia and a sinus infection. In March, she discovered several cysts in her left breast and was forced to go to surgery in D.C. On April 4th, they operated. Then doctors recommended a mastectomy. She asked her doctor about the cysts, and she was told she had a condition bordering on malignancy. There had been metastases, but she was not told. There was no radiation, and lymph nodes in the left side were removed. Determined to finish her book, she began dictating changes in the manuscript, which an assistant would type. That November, her literary agent, Mary Riddell, liked the chapter on birds, and thought the whole book might be titled Silent Spring. Then, ghastly, in late November 1960, she discovered a hard swelling on the third or fourth rib, a densive mass between rib and skin, so that within days there were two radiation treatments. Then in late January 61, she was sterilized and received 10 more treatments through February. She began working again on Silent Spring by the summer of 61 in Maine. Maine always energized her. Back in Silver Springs, Maryland in the late fall, she shoved herself harshly to finish The Greatness, polishing The Fable for Tomorrow, which begins the book. By year's end, she was sick again, almost blind with iritis and in pain, but struck onward, so that by the end of 62, she sent 15 of the 17 chapters to her publisher, and the same to The New Yorker. Her editor loved it, and wanted to publish it in the spring of 62. While polishing and revising and polishing, in March she discovered a few hard, hurtful lumps on the right side. A biopsy gave the grim news of more cancer to the right, so that in mid-March Rachel Carson began more radiation. She worked on Silent Spring in the bed in the mornings, and then to the hospital for radiation in the afternoons. And then April 20th, 1962, Silent Spring, despite the agony of its creator, was done. It was a moment for America. She ordered a wig so that she could start interviews, speeches, and appearances to stand by the science of her book. Then installments of Silent Spring began in The New Yorker on June 16th, causing a culture-shaking stir. The publication occurred in the public anger over thalidomide. The chemical companies fought back, but JFK's Secretary of the Interior backed Carson's book and advocated for pesticide regulation in the New Frontier that summer. Silent Spring was a Book of the Month Club selection and went on sale in stores September 27, 1962. There was a huge, huge flood of press interest and interviews, and considerable hostilities from conservatives and Kemsleys. A pesticide industry ooze group spent over $250,000 to attack Carson and her work. She was picked on as just an alarm-ringing woman, sort of a Cassandra of chemistry. The press was very attentive to her marital status, that is, single, and with the Cold War implication, communist and, like, sapphic, and the fact that she only had a master's degree. Then in 62, despite terrible pain in her neck, or sorry, terrible pain in her back, with Silent Spring number one in the bestseller list, most of the fall and during Christmas, she went through radiation treatments on her back. During the increasing hubbub from Kemsley's, Carson was always ill, yet worked hard, answering critics, doing outstanding stints on television, making excellent speeches, and shaping the PR battle. Then new tumors above the collarbone and another in her neck, after which another series of heavy radiation. She began suffering from angina in the spring of 63. Finally, the federal government issued a report on May 15, 1963, called The Use of Pesticides by the President's Science Advisory Committee. By September of 63, it was too painful to walk, yet she kept her fiery ice, kept up her fierce icy fight with the Scythe Man. Till March 13, 64, the disease entered her liver, and then on April 14, 1964, Rachel Carson passed away of a heart attack. Two-thirds of her estate she gave to the Nature Conservancy and to the Sierra Club. And you can pause by her monument on a street in Booth Harbor, Maine, to know the hukasi churning of the sea around us. So that's by it. With Rachel Carson.
All right, thank you, Jim. So before we go on to our first musical performance, I wanted to mention a few things. First of all, thank you, Indira, for letting us do this here at La Rev, 2848 Dundas Street West. We air on Monday afternoons at 2 p.m. on RadioRegent.com, but you can also go to AfterTheCollapse.net and listen to any of our past episodes at any time. And thanks to the Junction Craft Brewery for supporting this evening. Because of them, we're able to provide our poets and musicians a couple beers. So that's nice. So if I could call up Richard McCarthy now for the first song.
One of the mics here.
Yeah, okay, great. So, Richard, before I put the mic here for Indira, do you want to just talk a little bit about the song you are about to perform and why you chose it?
Sure, thanks, Lewis. Well, I picked the song. It has loosely something to do. I can relate to climate change. It's by the band called Wilco. It's called You Never Know. It's kind of a song sung to the young generation growing up now. And sometimes with the problems in the world and big issues with like climate change and the environment and stuff, it can become overwhelming. You can get pessimistic and think, well, we're screwed, so may as well just litter, or may as well just not pay attention to this. But this song kind of says not to wake up. Every generation gets this as part of your kind of teens, maybe, and use it as an impetus to overcome and keep your hope and activism alive.
All right. Okay. Thank you, Richard.
Okay, so this is You Never Know, and thanks to Indira for backing me up on vocals and the piano.
Come on, children, you act like children. Every generation thinks it's the end of the world. All you fat fathers get fit fast. Every generation thinks it's the past, thinks it's the end of the world. It's a dream. Long, heavy hell. I don't care anymore. I don't care anymore. It's a feeling we transcend. Everyone's here at the end. I don't care anymore. I don't care anymore. You never know. Black children, act your age. Put back the black medals and pearls. Oh, all you sore swallowers, pull yourself together. Every generation thinks it's the worst, thinks it's the end of the world. I don't care anymore. never know. Yeah, yeah, you never know.
Okay, thank you, Richard. The music you're hearing is our theme song, but it's somehow digital-analogized through the mixer. It's probably sounds as weird as it in its usual form. But anyway, you're listening to After the Collapse on RadioRegion.com. What are you saying, Jim? What are you trying to say? Oh, I see. Okay, well, I thought we were gonna do it together.
Yeah, you're sure.
Okay.
Yeah,
all right. So, do you Okay, so go ahead.
Oh, okay. So, on to the next poem. Our next poem is going to be by Ed Keenan. Ed Keenan is a former After the Collapse guest whose interview will rerun soon, I think, because it's vital to understanding contemporary issues. He's a City Hall reporter for the Toronto Star, the author of the excellent book on Toronto politics and the rise of Rob Ford, Some Great Idea. And so, please, Ed.
It's interesting because it's probably been over 10 years since I attempted to write poetry or read it anywhere. And back when I used to do that more frequently, I used to see Nick Beat, this Toronto poet and host, around town. And today I just learned that he died suddenly last night. Which is terrible news, I think, for the city's poetry community, because he was, first of all, a good guy and a good poet, but also the host of Howl, the radio program on CIUT 89.5 FM, which is, for many people, the only place in the city on the radio to regularly hear poetry from local poets. He was, of course, a fan of the Beats. And it was also appropriate sort of that I was reminded of him, that he came back up because of how I approached this poem. So I have to apologize because when Lewis asked me to do this, I said, hey, that sounds interesting. And he said, I'm sure you'll do great. And so I started looking up investigative poetry, and I thought, ah, that's neat. And so I started approaching this scholar poet, looking up all kinds of information and facts, and trying to start turning that into a poem, trying to figure out what I had to say about it, and having a lot of trouble. And so I'm not sure if what I've written qualifies as investigative poetry or poetry at all. but in the spirit of the Beats, or some of the Beats, I kind of, when the time came, I thought, okay, first thought, best thought, I will sit down and write a reaction to my attempt to make sense of the investigation into climate change. So there's a bit of confusion and ambivalence reflected in the poem, so I'll just read it. They say, save the planet, hug a tree, save the whales, protect the rainforests, but I'm selfish. I don't worry much about planets and wood and big fish. They say whales are mammals, but I don't worry much about fine distinctions because I'm selfish, and because I am selfish, I do worry much about saving the people. They say if we don't cut carbon emissions by blah before yada, the planet will overheat. I don't worry much about the fine distinctions because I do worry much that we are not doing blah and not doing yada. We're doing less than nada because we're selfish, they say. And because I'm selfish, I worry. They say the oceans will rise to swallow our cities like whales swallowing biblical men. The earth will burn or freeze or flood. They say it will do all of those things at once because we're arguing over big fish and whales. Carbon taxes and cap and trade systems, targeted reductions and jobs in the oil field. They say we need to get the details sorted, and we are doing less than nada. I worry. 10-year, 20-year, 50-year targets. I worry. They say we should think local. They say we should act global. We recycle and take transit, and we diaper our kids in cloth, so we're up to our arms in shit and guilt, acting local and thinking, realizing that we do not act global because we worry about fine distinctions. But the distinct problem is unfine. It is vast. It is as big as a million power plants and a billion people whose quality of life is improving, and they say it is our quality of life improving that will destroy our quality of life, our life, life. And because I am selfish, I worry about my quality of life and want to protect it, enjoy it while I can, but I worry. They say it may already be too late. We may have to spray chemicals that block out the sun, or build new flood, burn, freeze-proof cities, or build an ark and start again, or pray, they say. They say, too, they say maybe it's not too late if we do something drastic, if we enact wartime measures, if we act globally because it is an emergency that threatens all of civilization, and they write reports and sound alarms and protests in the streets, and they throw a brick through Starbucks window and sneer at people driving giant SUVs and hug trees and save whales, but they do not enact wartime measures to do something drastic globally. It doesn't feel like an emergency. We do not do blah or yada or even nada. We say, they say, we say, they say, we say, they say we should do something about that. Someday, they say. I worry because I am selfish. They are selfish. We are selfish. We are not going to do enough to save the planet, but that is not what worries me. The planet will survive. I worry we will not. I don't worry much about planets and wood and big fish and fine distinctions and blah and yada and nada because I am selfish. I worry about people, and I worry because they say, they say, they say. There you go.
All right, many thanks, Ed.
Yes, thanks. Oh, go ahead, Jim.
No, please.
Oh, what's going on? Oh, right. Okay, yes, thanks, Ed. That was fantastic. Another round of applause for Edward Keenan. It's very good. Okay, so our next musician is Indira Nanavati Gadina, who is also our host this evening at La Rev at 2848 Dundas Street West. And I know you don't want to say too much about why you chose this particular song, but maybe you could tell us the song that you chose and take a long time explaining why you chose it.
Okay. So the song I chose... Oh. I turned it down. Okay, can you hear me? Yeah. The song I chose is called Genius Next Door by Regina Spektor. Basically, the reason I chose it is throughout the song, they talk about a lake, and I feel like they're using it as a metaphor for more worldly problems, especially or more specifically related to climate change and global warming. In the song, the lake is said to have turned into porridge and turned thick as butter. This could represent the environmental problems accumulating, or it could be taken more literally as a lake which has become contaminated. The song seems to use examples such as the neighbors trying to keep it quiet or the local kids who would still go swimming. It seems to represent society and how we sometimes choose to ignore the problems threatening the environment or continue living as if they don't exist. Anyways, I'll go from there and just go play. Some say the local lake had been enchanted. Others say it must have been the weather. The neighbors were trying to keep it quiet, but I swear I could hear their laughter. So they jokingly nicknamed it the porridge, 'cause overnight that lake had turned as thick as butter. But the local kids would still go out swimming and drink games, and that to them it didn't matter. If you just hold in your breath till you've come back over and full, hold in your breath till you've thought things through, you fool. The genius next door was bussing tables, wiping clean the ketchup bottle labels, getting high and mumbling German fables. Didn't care as long as he was able to strip his clothes out by the dumpster every night when everyone was sleeping, to wade midway into that porridge, just him and the secret he was keeping. If you just hold in your breath till you've come back up and full, hold in your breath till you've thought things through, you fool. Film crew started arriving with coffees, donuts, and reporters. The kids were waking up hungover. The neighbors were starting up their cars. The garbage men were emptying out the dumpster. The atheists were praying full of sarcasm. The genius next door was sleeping, wishing that the antidote was orgasm. If you just hold in your breath till you've come back up in full, hold in your breath till you've thought things through, you foolish child.
Okay, thank you so much, Indira. That was so beautiful and a great introduction. Thank you so much.
You're listening to a special episode of After the Collapse, an interview-based social justice talk show airing Mondays from 2 to 3 on RadioRegent.com. This week, we break from our usual format to present our second investigative poetry night, recorded live at La Revolution, located at 2848 Dundas Street West in Toronto, on September 18th, 2014. Local poets and musicians presented original work and covers related to the theme of climate change. You can stream our archived shows, including the first investigative poetry night, as well as an interview with featured poet in this segment, Toronto Star columnist Edward Keenan, on afterthecollapse.net. We'll return to La Revolution in just a moment, but first, here's Bruce Colburn with Beautiful Creatures.
There's a knot in my gut as I gaze out today on the plains of the city, all polychrome gray. When the skin is peeled off it, what is there to say? Fortress to the shapes in the air, to the ache in the spirit we label despair. We create what destroys, bind ourselves to betray. The beautiful creature.
That was Beautiful Creatures by Bruce Colburn, and you're listening to After the Collapse, a social justice-themed show that airs Mondays from 2 to 3 on RadioRegent.com. Archived shows can be streamed at afterthecollapse.net. We now return to the live recording of our second investigative poetry night from La Revolution, located at 2848 Dundas Street West on September 18, 2014. In this segment, author and actor Andy Borman continues our investigation of climate change by offering a satiric take on the recent debates on the Northern Gateway Pipeline.
So you're listening to After the Collapse on RadioRegion.com. Just want to take this moment to thank everybody so far who's either prepared a poem or performed. You've all not exceeded my expectations because I know what you're capable of, but I really appreciate the effort. Jim and I really appreciate the effort that you've put in. Thank you. So with that, next we have up Andy Borman, who hosted our last investigative poetry night. And we love him so much, we asked him to come back and compose a poem for us. So here at La Rev at 2848 Dundas Street West, we have Andy Borman coming up. And once again, I want to thank the Junction Craft Brewery for supporting us tonight, too. All right, Andy Borman.
I, too, would like to thank the Junction Craft Brewery. I know this is investigative poetry, and I'm a lot more speculative than I am investigative, but I did look up some things and crunch some numbers. This is about sort of the PR battle with regards to the Northern Gateway Pipeline. There's a lot of PR on either side of things, obviously, and a lot of people on either, some sides have more money than the other. This is written from the perspective of a gigantic oil company, which you can probably guess who it is. It's basically less of a poem and more of a PR statement. And it's brought to you by Marineland. Marineland. Whales love it here more than oceans. Good day. And I do mean good day. Much has been made of our plans to link a dual bitumen pipeline from beautiful Bruderheim, Alberta, 1,177 kilometers to majestic Kitimat, British Columbia. We are pleased to announce that due to overwhelming public support, that this project will go ahead as planned. Pause for clapping. No, sorry, I'm not supposed to read the brackets. I'm sorry. Our company will put its exemplary environmental record to task and complete this extraordinary historic pipeline within the next 2 years. While we've paid good money to bury any concerns as to the impact of this project on the immediate and global climate, we would not be an award-winning corporate citizen if we did not extend to you a promise of our competency and reliability. This is our promise to you. First, all earthquakes within northern British Columbia, once the crude oil starts to flow, will be banned. We will work closely with the Harper government to draft legislation that ensures earthquakes will no longer be a possibility. We promise that if the unthinkable should happen, we will stop at nothing to recoup cleanup costs from any earthquake that should arise through vigorous legal action against that earthquake and its subsidiaries. We will sue that earthquake. Second, all displaced wildlife, including the majestic spirit bears, will receive compensation in the form of a gift basket. Each basket handpicked for the discerning tastes of each individual animal. Third, all islands within the Douglas Channel, our tanker corridor, including Costa Island, Loretta Island, Hawkesbury Island, Kitsaway Island, Gill Island, Ferrant Island, Finn Island, Campania Island, and Ashdown Island, all islands will be removed, either permanently or by Photoshop, thus ensuring safe tanker passage. Fourth, all tankers will have not one, but two qualified captains, each equipped with binoculars and whistles. Five, all spills, however unlikely, will be cleaned up with extensive PR. Six, jobs, mostly welding jobs. All welders in Canada who long to weld in the forest away from their families for months at a time will be employed. The dual pipelines will run 525,000 barrels of crude oil per day and will account for this, are you ready for this, 104 permanent jobs. That's 104. And finally, in closing, once all oil has been shipped to market, the dual pipelines will be turned into the world's longest water slide, available for future generations to enjoy. This is our promise to you. Thank you, and God bless you.
All right, fantastic. That was Andy Borman again. And now we have a song from the host of the open mic here, Lebrun, Michael Keith.
Hello.
All right. So if you could set the scene for us there, Mike.
I was a little confused. I was told the theme of the night was on having parrots for pets. So I composed a song called Naughty Polly. So I feel kind of embarrassed that I messed up. So I thought maybe I'd just do it anyways. And, no, I'm just kidding. Yes, climate change. that's the weather, right?
Yeah.
Yes, well, I thought a bit about that, and it's, so I don't know a lot of music really there, but I thought it'd be good to do maybe something by someone Canadian. I thought that someone like Bruce Cockburn deserves a great mention for all the great work that he's done. And just such, in terms of musicians and I, and I was listening to a bunch of different tunes and it was just kind of coming up fast. And then I thought of Neil Young too, who's done some great stuff. And so I decided I'd do a Neil Young thing, Oh Mother Earth, I saw him ages ago, saw a video of him playing that at Farm Aid. And I just thought it was a beautiful song and it talks a bit about, how I think our planet is probably pretty tired of human beings. And it's probably, I think we should consider ourselves lucky that we're still here. And probably at some time in the future, we won't be here. And that'd probably be the best thing that could happen for the planet.
Oh, where's Nick? Oh, Mother Earth, with your fields of green, once more laid down by the hungry hand, how long can you give and not receive and feed this world ruled by greed? Feed this world ruled by greed. Ball of fire in the summer sky, your healing light, your parade of days, are they betrayed by the men of power who hold this world in their changing hands, who hold this world in their changing hands. Streets where the numbers grow, respect Mother Earth and her healing ways, or trade away our children's days, or trade away our children's days. Respect Mother Earth and her healing ways, or trade away our children's days.
Thank you, Michael Keith. Okay, so that basically brings us to the close of our show. You've been listening to After the Collapse. This will be aired on Radio Regent on Monday, this Monday at 2 p.m. And you can also go to afterthecollapse.net to listen to this podcast or any of the other episodes that we've done in the past. Jim, do you have anything you want to say?
We just want to once again thank La Revolution.
They can't hear you.
Once again thank La Revolution for hosting us here.
Yes, thank you, Indira and La Rev.
And thank you to the poets, Andy Borman and Ed Keenan. Thank you to all the musicians, Michael Keith, Richard McCarthy, and Indira Kadina.
Nanavita Kadina.
Maribina Kadina. Thank you. thank you to the Junction Craft Brewery for the libations. Thank you to Ed Sanders for inspiration. And thank you to all of you for coming.
Yes, thank you.